A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. On this edition, I'm joined once again by Jack Howard. And if you've been watching the Secrets of Cinema series on BBC4, you may well know that the show that goes out on Thursday is all about spy movies. The first two programs we did, the first one was about superheroes, the second one was about British history, but the third one is about spies in the movies. So, in order to, well, celebrate the return of Secrets of Cinema, Jack and I decided to sit down and discuss our favourite spy movies. So, sit back in the comfort and safety of your own home, and I hope you are all obeying the current regulations about staying in your own home, and enjoy me and Jack Howard talking spies.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. You're asking that in a very sensitive way.
I'm asking because, you know, like me, I know how much of your life revolves around cinema, which obviously is one of the things that, you know, is absent from our lives. But how are you bearing up?
Yeah, it is a bit of a weird one. To be honest, I'm kind of enjoying... And look, I know there's a very serious thing that's going on right now and people are literally dying. But there's part of me that's kind of enjoying the limitations of this. Because I'm a self-employed person, every day I wake up and I think...
Hey, welcome to my world.
Yeah. I wake up and think, what are the plethora of options I could... And because I have to make that decision, sometimes I find that quite difficult. My brain struggles with that sometimes, about all the different decisions I could make. But now it's been restricted to just, here's what you can do in your own home. And in order to not go mad...
So this is
creative.
Like a kind of, this is like Lars von Trier imposing restrictions on his filmmaking, you know,
sure.
like the Obstacles film.
But that's why in terms of filmmaking, that's why I think that Edgar Wright's best film still is Shaun of the Dead. Because I think they still had, I mean, that's just like one example, but I think having those restrictions on you sometimes can actually breed something more interesting. And right now I'm personally just enjoying my day-to-day a bit more than I usually would, because my day hasn't changed that much as a self-employed person. I usually work from home and all the rest of it anyway. But these days I'm finding myself being a bit more creative with my time and thinking, what can I actually do rather than having all these different options? I've only got a few now. And not going to the cinema is difficult, but I've started an isolation film club with my friends, so we're hitting play on Netflix at the same time.
Well, apparently, yeah, the Netflix film club thing is quite a big deal. I see that Empire are also doing a thing about you. When there's a movie on television, you all watch at the same time and talk to each other on Twitter. But there's loads of people have found ways of watching communally. And I think what's really fascinating about this is it demonstrates that even in isolation, people want that communal experience.
Yes, they do.
And they will use whatever technology is possible to get. And I just love that idea because it kind of proves that there is something about the communal experience of cinema. We all talk so much about how, you know, it's better to watch films at home because, you know, you don't get people eating crisps, and I've moaned about that. But you take the communal experience away and people will go to such lengths to reproduce it.
The amount of times
I won't
watch a film sometimes because I'll go to my housemates. Do you fancy watching this? And they'll be like, I'm not really in the mood. And I'll be like, oh, fine, I won't. And
so
I don't really fancy the idea of experiencing it on my own, but...
But isn't that great? Doesn't that tell you something that over, you know, after 100 years of cinema, that thing about the communal experience, even if you're not all sitting in the same place, still, there is something about cinema that brings audiences and people together. And when they physically can't be brought together, now, thanks, God bless it, thanks to the miracle of the internet and Twitter and Netflix and all the rest of it, we can somehow stay in contact and, you know, get that experience, which I think the thing that I'm really missing, I never realised that I would do.
Go on.
You know, because the way my week would usually work is Mondays and Tuesdays are national press shows, you know, week of release screenings. So 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock.
And this must be the first time this hasn't happened to you.
Jack, it's the first time it's happened in 30 years. Yeah. It's the strangest thing. And what I've realised is how much I miss it. How much I've missed turning up at a preview screening and seeing Linda Marek and Wendy Eyde and Simran Hans and Pete Bradshaw and, you know... And
it's like turning up to your office. Like, yeah, you're seeing your work colleagues.
And it's so bizarre because... I mean, even if we don't talk very much, you know, often it's just like, all right, there you go, yeah, you know, like that. I have really missed that feeling of companionship. And another thing which I think is good, and we'll get onto the subject of this podcast in just a moment. Another thing which I think is good about it is that I have worried in the past about whether or not the comradeship of film criticism has fractured of late. And what I've realised is that it hasn't, because I'm missing something, yeah, that I didn't even realise I had.
Sometimes it's just the presence of another person,
yeah,
and just knowing that energy is there, and the fact that you're all experiencing something at the same time is just even something you're subconsciously aware of.
Just sitting in a room with a bunch of other critics, knowing that, I mean, I always sit in the same place in the same screening room. So, you know, like, for example, if I'm on, there's a screening room on Dean Street, so, you know, Linda Marek is in front of me, and then, you know, Wendy would be over to the left, and Pete would be two rows down, and Simran would be three rows. You know, I mean, I can literally, yeah, I can place where everyone would be, and Van would be over there on the far left. And,
I bet, you know, a lot of people don't really know that everybody has their place. It is like an office; like, everyone sits at the same desk.
Yes,
it's just interesting that, like, no one would take Kermode's seat, and don't you dare.
But also, it's different seats in different screening rooms, which is the really weird thing. It's anyway. This podcast wasn't just for us to ramble on. It's been nice to do some. We'll carry on doing it. Because Secrets of Cinema is on at the moment. Hey, it's my series. It's my podcast. If I'm not going to plug it, who's going to do it? Okay. And you haven't even seen the superheroes one yet.
It only came out yesterday.
Yeah, but podcast is going out like a week's time. So, you know, by the time you've seen it, are listening to this, you will have seen it. And
Well, if it'll make you feel better, yeah, I won't watch it until this podcast has gone out.
What made me feel better? I want you to watch it and tell me what you think.
Well, okay.
Because when the superheroes thing went out, and it was all lovely, and Twitter response was great, and everything was great, and I'm sitting there thinking, I wonder what Jack thinks.
Oh, that's
No, because you and I have had a lot of conversations, yeah, about superheroes. So I am actually kind of, you know.
Well, on the next podcast, we'll bring it up.
Well, on this podcast, we're going to talk about spy movies, because the third in the Secrets of Cinema series, which we may be, however this is panning out and when this is going out, is about spies. Actually, when we made it, we were thinking that it was going to run right up to the release of the Bond movie, which of course is now...
Now it's got, you know, so much time to die.
License to Kill, very good. License to Kill, but not to sneeze. So anyway, that's what we should... But the programme itself all got made, and it's all finished, and we're very lucky that we kind of got everything in under the wire, so that's great. So, because that was kind of in the ether, you and I thought, well, you know, let's keep things going without sort of new releases. So we decided to do a podcast on... Well, I thought we were doing top five spy movies.
Yeah, I thought we were doing top three.
Because you're a lightweight. And actually, it's not your fault. I texted Nick to say, Nick, are we doing three? And he went, no, five. So you can blame Nick. Nick?
Sorry.
Fuck you, Nick.
Fuck you, Nick. Yeah.
Anyway, start that as a new running joke on this show.
We'll do. That's a new feature. Fuck you, Nick.
Yeah. Okay. That'll be our own theme music in a few episodes.
So we've decided that we'll do top three, but I'll probably talk about the other two that I went as well. So, how do you want to start this?
I think it's important to say that we're excluding James Bond. So because Bond isn't, we want to do our Bond. If it eventually comes out,
It will come out. Well, they can't spend that much money.
The world is insane right now. Who knows what's going to happen?
Okay, I'm pretty certain that we're going to get through this, and the Bond movie is going to be released. Okay.
I like the chaos right now. I'm unsure.
Yeah. but there we go. You know,
we're going to do our Bond films later in the year.
Yeah. When this
spy one, we're going to exclude Bond from the options.
Yes.
And that's kind of difficult. I don't know if you struggled at all, but... Well, you probably didn't, but I struggled.
Well, I literally just did the Secrets of Cinema programme, so I didn't struggle.
Yeah, sure.
It's like, you know... It was me and Nick and Kim and John sitting in a room talking about spy movies for like a day, which was kind of the best primer, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, shall I go first or you want to go first?
You can go first.
All right, so the first thing I want to say is that one of the things I like about spy movies is that... is that the term spy movies covers a number of things, and it is indicative that many of the things that I think of as the best spy movies are not necessarily things that you think of immediately.
You mean
as
they're
spy
like
movies.
A part of another genre?
Yeah, or they encompass other genres, or they're movies that are about spies, but you know, are that's one of the things I really like about it. So at number three, I mean, there's we'll do top three, and I'll chuck in the other ones. But at number three, okay. And this is funny because this isn't in the program. And in fact, it wasn't something that I was thinking about when we were making the program. And it's only something that occurred to me in the fairly recent, you know, like in the last day or so when I was thinking about, because I started thinking about, you know, movies, spies and deception of it, is Ang Lee's Lost Caution.
I haven't seen that
okay,
film.
Okay, so, well, I don't know how widely seen it was, okay. It is a really, I looked it up because I remembered it being, there's a spy, it's about spy.
It's called Lost Caution.
Lost Caution, yeah, which is a really sort of strange title anyway. So I looked up how it was defined, you know, you go on IMDb and everything. It is described as an espionage erotic period drama. And I thought, yeah, that's how I remember it, okay? So essentially, it's Hong Kong 1938, and it's about students from Hong Kong University planning to assassinate a government agent. And apparently the story is loosely based on real events, about which I, you know, knew nothing at all. But, of course, what it's centrally about is about seduction. It has some fairly explicit sex scenes in it that caused it to be a sort of cause a celeb around the world in terms of censorship controversy. I read this really terrifying thing. Tang Wei, who's the lead actress, was apparently ostracized, and this is straight from Wiki, ostracized from China's movie industry after making the film.
Oh,
and
wow.
Did not work for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Because the State Administration of Radio, Film and Television disapproved of her performance of sexual acts in Lost Caution.
What year was this made?
I think it was about 10 years ago. 2007. Right. Wow. I mean, I'm now getting to the point that, you know.
10 years.
10 years, it seems fairly recent. Okay. So,
The Social Network is 10 years old.
That's terrifying.
And Inception.
No, that's really terrifying. But listen, with I remember when I went to see Lost Caution, and I went to see it, I remember exactly the preview screening room that I went to see it. Mm. It was in the downstairs.
And the chair you sat in.
Yes. No, I mean, exactly that. And I didn't know anything about it at all, other than that it was a potential awards contender. And it was Ang Lee, you know, who has films I really, really like. Or liked. I have, you know, recently, I just think he's kind of, I don't know why he's off with these kind of weird experiences. But when I saw the film, I thought of it as, because I'm kind of quite interested in the erotic thriller genre, not least because my partner, Linda Reese Williams, wrote a book about erotic thrillers.
Right.
And I was sort of very fascinated by that thing about, you know, sexuality in mainstream cinema. Not porn, but used in mainstream cinema. And obviously taking, because there's another Linda Williams, my partner is Linda Ruth Williams, and there's another Linda Williams who's written an academic book in America about hardcore. And so actually they're very good friends. They know each other very well, right. And their work gets confused. And in the case of Lost Caution, it is a mainstream movie, but it was NC-17 in America because it was thought of as very explicit. And it is a film about interpersonal intimacy and deception. And Ang Lee was absolutely, he said, the sex scenes cannot be cut because the story of the film is told in the sex scenes.
Mm.
And I remember talking to Kim Newman once, and Kim was asked by I think it was the Dogma people. He was asked if he would write a porn film for them. And he said, you know, the only way that would ever be an interesting project would be if you could write a porn film in which the plot was in the sex scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kim can do anything. And he's, you know, such an erudite writer, and he could find a way of doing it, you know. So you can't take them out because that's where the plot is. But what I thought was really fascinating about Lost Caution is it's a spy movie. It is about all those, you know, double dealing and deception and everything. But that deception is actually really crystallized in these very intimate scenes.
In the scenes where people feel the most exposed.
Yeah, exactly. When you think that everything is out there,
and you think that everything is, and those are the moments as well in the human experience where you're supposed to feel most present and most honest.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet in those moments, there's still this, I guess, I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm assuming there is like an uncertainty of whether or not who's being honest.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I think you'd love it. I think it's a really interesting.
That's going on
Lost Caution, go on.
My number three is so different.
Yeah.
It is Kingsman: The Secret Service.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I am a huge fan of Matthew Vaughn. Oh, I mean, the same as Ang Lee. Yeah. I was until he made Kingsman 2.
Yes.
Like, where, I mean, let's just do that for a second. Kingsman, The Golden Circle, to me, is it was as disappointing as when they made Kick-Ass 2. But I sort of...
and that's majorly disappointing.
It really is. And Kick-Ass 2 was... Oh, let's take everything about the first Kick-Ass that we think people liked and amplify that and miss all the points of what people actually liked. Yeah. And Kingsman, The Golden Circle...
It's exactly the same.
But Matthew Vaughn didn't direct Kick-Ass 2. He did direct Kingsman 2. Yeah. And I was like, oh, he's never done a sequel before.
Did direct Kick-Ass 2?
Jeff,
that's it.
It is some guy called Jeff.
Jeff
something, okay. Who cares?
Yeah.
Matthew Vaughn had never directed a sequel before, so I was very excited about the prospect of why is he coming back to this one? Like, what is it about this that Kick-Ass didn't have that he's thinking there's something here? And I think now the answer is that it was a massive success.
Yeah.
The first Kingsman was a huge success, and he thought, I can do a sequel now and make myself a franchise. And Kingsman 2, sorry to just go on a rant about the film,
isn't
my favourite, but Kingsman 2, everything about it just felt so... Obviously, I could see through all the decisions, like having Channing Tatum and Halle Berry and Julianne Moore and Elton John in it, just to have these people on the poster, because there's literally a moment in it where you introduce people like Jeff Bridges and Halle Berry and Channing Tatum, like they're in a sitcom, like they turn around and it's almost like they want to have like a name tag underneath them, like like this person's in it, and then you just put them on ice for the whole thing, and bringing back Colin Firth from the dead is like
not just a bit dead, but majorly dead,
shot in the face.
I know, and the worst thing about it is that when you bring that character back, you undermine
everything
about the first film. Like, yep. Oh, he's not dead. No one's
because
dead.
Because one of the big themes in terms of its fourth wall breakingness of the first film was this ain't that kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he literally says that as he shoots him in the face, and then they bring him back from the dead. So I guess it is that kind of movie.
Yeah.
How did Matthew Vaughn not know that? There's so much.
There's also the whole thing about, you know, Elton John doing an unfunny cameo. Oh, it's not a cameo. It's a whole role.
He's a supporting actor.
He's actually terrible all the way through the film.
And there's a bit where he's flying through the sky and he's doing a flying kick and he just looks and I think he winks at the camera. And I remember being in the screening room and just detaching, almost similar to what happened in Rise of Skywalker. Like, I was like, okay, I have to sort of create some distance between this. And then I was so upset after seeing Golden Circle that I went back and watched Kick-Ass, The First Kingsman, and X-Men First Class.
Okay,
to be like, oh, Matthew Vaughn is a good director.
Okay. So tell me why Kingsman Secret Service.
So, big fan of Kick-Ass. Kick-Ass, I think, took everything from the superhero genre, turned it on its head, and then created, if you did it on a graph, it started out as this real-world, self-aware movie, and then across that graph, it sort of grew into becoming, oh no, we're standing shoulder to shoulder with other superhero movies now. And I think he took that exact same formula and then put it onto a spy genre, and took a lot of the stuff. I'm a big fan of James Bond. Grew up watching it almost obsessively, where my mum at one point had to ban me from watching James Bond films in the week, like on school nights. I was not allowed to watch them.
Such an annoying kid.
I must have been. I had a suit that they bought me from a charity shop that was obviously oversized. I got a replica of the Wolf of PPK.
Wow.
Like all the stuff. I was obsessed. And so
all your school friends go, here comes Jack Howard, licensed to kill,
with his slick back hair. So taking that Roger Moore cheesy element of Bond that we hadn't seen for a long time and putting it into a modern context was like just super, super fun. But I think that I'm a sucker for not only that sort of fourth wall, almost postmodern storytelling, that's sort of my generation's whole shtick, but I also just like the fact that you're seeing something much more camp and silly that you don't usually see in spy movies these days. Everything's a lot more gritty and grounded, and it just stood out above everything else. And I'm a sucker for great action scenes. I think there's such great storytelling to be, as you'll see more in my other choices, there's such great storytelling to be done, as we all know, without dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
But in an action movie, I think you can learn so much about who somebody is and what somebody's like. Like the first scene in the pub where Colin Firth beats up all those thugs.
After shutting the door.
And then, yes, the man is maketh man.
Yeah, exactly. That's the...
Such a great... I mean, like, what an iconic piece of imagery as well. Like, you see that moment and you know exactly what is going on. But then he sits back down and goes, I'm going to finish my lovely pint of Guinness. You know what I mean? Like, from the beginning, you get who this person is and the dynamic between them. And I love the classic storytelling of My Fair Lady, and they even reference that in the movie. Yeah, and it also feels very modern with the tech guy wanting to save the world, but by doing it, creating a human cull. Like, it all just feels kind of relevant, but in a really out of this world, large scale spy way. And it has so many different, this is the difference as well between the second one and the first one, so many different exciting things to watch in it. So you have the fight scenes, and the church one especially, like, stood out. I remember the first time I watched that, my jaw dropped.
Yeah, I felt the same way about the church scene because of everything, including the fact that it's the church scene.
Yes, yes. And Colin Firth doing it. What genius casting.
I know.
Like, to be able to take somebody like him, who we know to be upstanding and British and proper and Pride and Prejudice and Bridget Jones's Diary, yeah, the King's Speech, Oscar-winning Colin Firth, who's built himself up to this place, and now he's killing a bunch of racists.
In a church.
In a church. But, like, and setting it to, like, this is the genius of Matthew Vaughn as well, like, setting that sort, it's not an original thing to do, but it's something that I think he's perfected, is setting, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, yeah, with Hit Girl,
yeah,
setting really horrific stuff to really upbeat, catchy music, so yeah, that yeah, church scene is done to Freebird, yeah, and it just immediately, you just, so great. And the decision as well to make it a racist church, like, we want to be able to have this ridiculous, over-the-top, violent action scene. How can we make people root for him killing everybody in the room?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's make them all horrible, deplorable people. Brilliant.
Incidentally, if you think that use of Freebird is great, you should, or you shouldn't, but you should see Rob Zombie's use of Freebird in, is it The Devil's Rejects?
Right.
Which, in which it's like, it's the opposite of great.
Right.
It's like absolutely the shittest shitness of shit ever. Mm-hmm. And you're just going, really? So, really? You know, it's like, there's no distance between those two things at all. Now, so let me ask you,
let's have a conversation about this.
The bum note, you know.
Yeah, I remember even the first time I watched it,
terrible.
I cringed and thought, oh no, what it's doing is it's taking the piss out of the Take Me Around the World One More Time, James scene and overtly doing it. But it's the worst.
So crass.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's not, I get what the joke is, I get what they're doing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they've nailed it.
So I think it's a nasty moment that for half the audience goes like, you know, oh, really? The gag is, just in case anybody doesn't know. Well, actually, Jack, what is the gag?
So the princess is locked away and he wants to save her. And she says, if you do it, we can do it in the asshole. And he goes, I'll be right back.
And then at the end,
he goes in and
she turns over and the camera zooms in on her.
Well, you know what's about to happen, and Merlin is watching it on a camera and goes, oh, and then just closes.
It's
closes
just like,
it's just all the, I get it. It's taking the piss out of the Roger Moore stuff, but it just feels like the wrong fucking joke.
I think it's
misplaced.
I think it strikes such a bum note. And that, that's how I said it in the review. And here's an interesting thing. I think Taron Egerton feels the same way.
He definitely does.
And I know for a fact that he felt awkward about
the fingering scene in the second one.
Yeah,
he didn't do it. It was the girl. It was the girl's boyfriend who did the close up of it to make sure. Because Taron didn't want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, regardless of who's... It just shouldn't be in the film.
No.
And it's like you say, it's like they took all the things that were wrong with the first film and went, let's make the second film about that.
Yes.
And you go, no, that's literally the opposite of what you
should have done. And it's a shame that exists in this film, because I think the reason why I love it so much, and I could talk about all the specifics of the action and all the rest of it, but I think the reason why I love it so much is it takes... Again, it's a postmodern thing. It takes all the clichés and all the cheesy stuff about the spy genre and lovingly accepts it and amplify it. The gadgets, the scale, the guns, the action, like, it takes everything about that spy genre and embraces it and makes you sort of remember why this sort of tone can work.
Okay.
And then I think it ends it, as you say, on a bum note.
On a bum note.
And you left with that feeling going, oh.
Yeah, no, it's amazing how much.
Because they strike it so well with the rest of it. Like then, I say, the church
then,
scene.
And then somehow that thing just, like, it throws all that goodwill out the window. And that, I think, is a real kind of.
Yeah.
And also, it feels to me like Matthew Vaughn going, yeah.
I also have a problem with the use of Dizzy Rascal's bonkers.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I. I think that it's incredibly uncool. And I think it's a very cool film. And even some of the costume design, like the fact that Eggsy is wearing like these big trainers that have got like wings on them.
Yeah.
It just feels a little bit like, I mean, it's iconic now, obviously, because that's what the character looks like. But when it came out at the time, Bonkers was at least 6 years old. Like, why are you putting Bonkers in this film? You've already got like a, you know, because this is a problem, I think, with all of Matthew Vaughn's film, but I get it. There's a lack of diversity in the film. And to be honest, I mean, I don't want to make it an issue that the film isn't bringing up, but there's a lot of white people in it. And obviously, when he goes to the Kingsman School, everybody there is from Oxford or Cambridge, and they're all tough twats. But what would have happened in the film if Eggsy was a black kid? Like, how would that have changed the dynamic of it? And I don't want to make it like a race thing. Obviously not. Like, I don't think that would have strengthened the film at all. But there's something about like using Dizzy Rascals, Bonkers, that just makes it super white. Yeah. Like, it just makes it feel like, what are cool kids listen to? It just feels a little bit like, ugh. But so I have my criticisms of it. But ultimately, I remember seeing it for the first time and just being complete, like, my expectations were succeeded and they were already high.
Okay.
Big fan of Matthew Vaughn. I hope that The King's Man, whenever we see that, is good, because I want him to win back some goodwill.
Oh yes, very, very nice.
You're going to need a pair of shoes to go with your suit.
An Oxford is any formal shoe with open lacing. This additional decorative piece is called broguing.
Oxford's not brogues.
Words to live by, Eggsy. Words to live by.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So let's move on to number two. And shall I go first?
Or, mm-hmm.
Okay. So for number two, I was resting between these. I'm going to go for North by Northwest. I was also...
Obviously, brilliant choice.
39 Steps was the other thing that was in there. I mean, and one of the things we talked about in Secret of Cinema was the way in which, you know, Hitchcock is right there in the DNA of what we think of as the modern spy movie. And also how much what North by Northwest was doing then influenced the look of Bond. And we're not doing Bond, but it was very important. But I
just even the way... the suits and
everything about the way, but the key for it for me is this, and this relates to something that you were just saying. I think the reason North by Northwest is genius is because the balance between the character stuff and the action stuff is perfect. You know, action is character. And when people say North by Northwest, and even with the poster, you think of the crop duster scene.
Yes.
Right? But the crop duster scene only works because of everything you know about the character. And I think that, I mean, obviously, this is hardly revolutionary. Hitchcock was a really good director. And,
right.
You know,
Tell me more.
It's like amazing. He really knew how to keep that balance. You know, it's, you know, between talking and not talking and between action and not action. It's, you know, I think he's some kind of auteur, Jack.
I mean,
I think, you know, and the Beatles are great as well.
I just
you know.
Love the idea of us having a genuine conversation. No one's ever said these things before.
and in a way, that's the problem with saying North by Northwest is it's a kind of back of the net. Yeah, like, you know, like you said, yeah, of course. It's, of course, North by Northwest.
The thing is, I was considering North by Northwest, but I didn't. It felt like I'd be a poser to pick it.
Okay.
Because I like North by Northwest.
Well, I am a poser, you know.
I like North by Northwest a lot, but I don't find myself going back to it a lot. It's not the one that I, in terms of spy movies, that I always think, I really want to watch that one.
That's okay.
I don't know why. I think it's brilliant, but it's probably just.
I think it's fresh in my mind because we use quite a lot of it in Secrets of Cinema, and it was true that even just watching it on the screen, you're going, "This is really good. This is really, really good."
And Christopher McQuarrie, who is the new auteur in charge of Mission Impossible, he references Die Hard a lot and North by Northwest a lot in terms of like writing and what the rules are, that North by Northwest doesn't follow the rules of writing that everyone will tell you, that the mother character is only there when you need her and then she's gone for the rest of the film and nobody cares, and Hitchcock doesn't care, but she's there to serve her purpose and then she's gone. I just like how even now that movie is still, I mean, I think that Casino Royale still owes a lot to North by Northwest in terms of...
Well, I think every Bond afterwards does. I mean, with the exception of some of the Brosnans, which owe a little bit more to kind of 70s television. But, you know, I think... So, look, it's a safe and easy choice.
Is there something in North by Northwest that like really stands out?
Yeah, the key for me is that it's the balance between action and character. Because actually, the whole thing about spy movies is you can have spy movies with no action at all, and you can have spy movies with nothing but action.
Yep.
And what North by Northwest manages to do, as I said, everyone thinks the poster is the crop duster, right? You watch the film, that's a moment, more than a moment, but it's an element. And the reason the crop duster works isn't just because you go, well, that is really brilliantly put together. It's because of everything else that's happening around.
It's the same. I think it's the same as with Spielberg do it with Jaws.
People think
they want the shark.
Yeah, but they don't.
And I mean, we didn't have a sequel to North by Northwest, but we've had sequels to Jaws, and we've shown that that's not what works, is it?
I have nothing to do with this.
Call the police.
Wait a minute. Don't come any nearer. You get back.
Right, come on. What's your number two?
My number two is...
Raise the bar.
The Coen Brothers... Burn After Reading.
Oh, wow, I hate that film.
Oh, great! Let's have a conversation.
Right, go ahead.
I adore Burn After Reading.
Okay, it's terrible.
It's really not. It's one of my favourite Coen Brothers films.
Go ahead.
It's the film...
I'm so surprised!
Yeah, they made this film after No Country for Old Men, and it feels like they needed a break. Because No Country for Old Men is fantastic. It's so good. I think it's a modern classic. Mm-hmm. And Burn After Reading, the first time I watched it, I was 16 when it came out, Burn After Reading, so it's been with me for most of my adult life. It is just such a fun, silly, ridiculous film about how nothing matters and how chaotic everything is. And I think all the characters are so well drawn and interesting. Brad Pitt delivers one of my favourite Brad Pitt performances of all time. It's got one of the most surprising spoilers for Burn After Reading, if you haven't seen it. It's 12 years old, but if you haven't seen it, where Brad Pitt gets shot in the wardrobe, still, I think is, I mean, it's just, it's the film is shot because Roger Deakins wasn't available. It's shot by
Emmanuel Lubezki. Chivo.
Yeah.
For short.
Yeah. And it competes with Deakins, and you can tell that the way that, I mean, I think he's amazing. Obviously he's won 3 Oscars in a row, which I don't think anyone has ever done. And it's just, I don't know what it is about this film, but there's something that invites me in every single time. I think it's the stupidity of everything, and you are outside of them and you're watching them make mistakes. You're almost like above the maze watching them make stupid mistakes, which is kind of the opposite of way that Nolan makes films.
Yeah.
He wants you to be in there with them making the wrong turn, but you're above them. And then the introduction of J.K. Simmons halfway through the film being like, what are they doing? Oh, all right, well, I guess just come back to me when it makes sense. I just love that from the very beginning, like the zoom in from the Earth, like going in, yeah. like it, almost like it could have gone anywhere. Like it could have told any story, and it just happened to go there and find this one, and then it zooms back out again, just to be like, yeah, that was just one of many different things that we could have told. I love the story of George Clooney thinking he's being followed by spies, and he's just got this like inherent paranoia about everything that's going on. And it turns out it's because he's being followed by his wife's divorce lawyers. So, and then it makes him inherently paranoid by the end, so that he, when he actually is potentially being followed by people. I love that the whole time Frances McDormand's character just wants to get some cosmetic surgeries. It's just so funny. And then she gets what she wants by the end of it. Like, that's her whole character arc, is that she gets what she wants because she knows too much. And she doesn't want to sell secrets. She just wants money to be able to change the way she looks. Everything's so superficial and ridiculous.
Okay, I have to tell you that listening to you talk about it makes me think I should go back and watch it again. I mean, for me, the Coen Brothers movies break into two camps, which are the ones I love and then the ones in which they're indulgent. And I've always included, incidentally, Big Lebowski in that. I'm not a Big Lebowski fan
either.
But hearing you talk, I mean, I just thought, you know, Burn After Reading, or Burn After Reading, as I've always called it. I've just always thought it was kind of the most ultra indulgent frippery. It's been a joy to hear you talk about it. There's one gag in it which I did laugh at, which is J.K. Simmons at the end. We goes, "What have we learned? I guess
we learned not to fucking do it again."
That's right. Yes, that joke did, but that was partly because I'd sat all the way through the film.
What a clusterfuck!
That's right. Why?
Fuck me! And then he closes the file.
So look, okay. So
it's so quotable,
and it's like it's 90 minutes long, right? It's not long.
Bang, it's in and out. I'm a massive sucker for a get in, get out, get it done.
Well, I agree. So maybe. I've only seen it once.
Please do revisit it. Okay. And just go in knowing what you're getting this time.
So I will watch Burn After Reading. Yep. You watch Lost Caution. Okay?
I absolutely will watch Lost Caution.
And we will come back and we will revisit this. Okay. Yep.
And you are somebody who says that you should watch films twice.
Yes, I mean, I quite often think that, you know, you it's only the second time round that you actually see the film for what it is.
And the thing is well, like, I say it's all ridiculous and silly, but the scene and the music by Carter Burwell, and it's one of the most specific, interesting soundtracks that I think, because the Coen Brothers don't tend to use music very much.
Yeah.
And when they do, it's very
specifically placed. Although they've worked often with Carter Burwell.
Yes. And No Country for Old Men, I don't think, has a score. I don't think there's any music.
I just remember opening and closing almost in silence.
Yeah, it's the voiceover of...
That's right, and the dream.
I don't think there's any music in No Country for Old Men, which is brilliant. And I love that they are brave enough, I mean, they're the Coen Brothers, to just make things work just with the imagery. And they're still tense and they still work, even more so sometimes in the silence. But the drums and the way that Carter Burwell uses music in it is... nothing else I've ever heard in a film. The scene that I'm talking about, where it ends with Brad Pitt getting shot in the face, where it starts with him like doing this little dance when he's the people who are watching on the Patreon can enjoy my little rendition of the Brad Pitt dance when he's listening to stuff in his iPod, and then when he goes and breaks into the house, it's this weird combination of quite silly and fun. Like when he climbs over a wall, he like almost like a dog like sort of scrambles his legs. It's very cartoonish, and then he breaks a window, and everything's kind of this weird mix between actual suspense and silly cartoon.
But that ends
with him getting shot in the face, so you're like, oh shit, no, this is
but that goes
serious.
Back to the Coens and, you know, and Sam Raimi, mm-hmm. and all that, you know, and Sonnenfeld and everything, that whole kind of cartoon.
It's kind of similar in farcical ways to something like Parasite.
Okay, fine,
do you know what I mean? Like it's not at all. Like the tone is so different, and it's thematically not really about anything other than chaos
and as J.K. Simmons says, what the fuck.
You know, this is a major inconvenience for us, and we just thought a reward.
So it's money. So it's money. You want money. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Why not?
Listen to me.
Am I out of line here?
Listen to me, you two clowns. Listen to me very, very carefully. You have no idea what you're doing. And I warn you.
You warn us. You warn us?
Yes.
You warn us? Let me tell you something, Mr. Intelligence.
We warn you.
We will call you back with our demands.
Cut. Hello?
Chad.
Chad, don't play his game.
Explain how this
Sorry.
Will
Jeez.
The nerve of that guy.
I am very fucking surprised he did not give us that reward.
Okay, so I'm going to go back and watch that. So, number one, okay, best spy movie of all time.
Before you say what number one is, I want everyone to know that we had a call about this podcast before we did it to say what we were going to do.
Yeah.
And Mark, just called dibs on this one. Like he just said, oh, just so you, we never know each other's list before going in. But Mark just went, by the way, I'm doing this. Yeah. So I couldn't choose
this
film.
No, you couldn't choose it. Okay. So I've chosen...
Which is unfair.
But it's fine, but it's my podcast. So I've chosen the Thomas Alfred Edison Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And the reason that I've chosen that as my favourite spy movie is, as I have said a million times, it's not about spies. It's so not about spies. Despite the fact it has the word spy in the title and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is probably one of the most famous, you know, sort of embodiments of what it's not about spies. I mean, it is about spies in the same way that Jaws is about a shark.
Social Network is not about Facebook.
Exactly. What Tinker
it maybe is one of the only films that there's a spy film where it is more about the personal lives than the actual job.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is about a bunch of middle-aged men sitting in rooms worrying. Mm-hmm. And
you relate to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I'm literally... I mean, okay, firstly, I love all the design and the production design and the fact that it evokes a particular period, that you can smell the nicotine in the walls, that the, you know, that kind of beige colour... It just permeates everything. Secondly, I think it's a brilliant ensemble cast.
It is.
I mean, every single
every time it cuts to a new scene, you're like, oh, this person's in it. Oh, this person's in it.
But also, you don't think, oh, that's a celebrity performance. Yeah. You think that's the person there because they're the best cast for doing it. I love Alfredson anyway, and I had absolutely loved Let the Right One In. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, that was
shame really... about the snowman.
Yeah, which was apparently never finished.
Apparently, whose fault's that, though?
No, I know. I'm not. I think even Alfredson thinks it's a terrible film.
Yeah, I think he does.
I mean, I think he knows that. I mean, it is a terrible film.
It really is.
Like, really.
It's one of the weirdest cinema experiences I've ever had.
Because you're just sitting there going, what? Because
it's like Fassbender's doing it, and director of Tinker Tailor, and like, what? And J.K. Simmons is in it, like, hiding behind a bookshelf at one point, like, in this weird creep. I was like, what decision was this? Like, what film were you making? It's like, it's almost like, I hate to say it, but it's almost like Suicide Squad being like, yeah, but there was a different cut of it. Yeah, but the scenes that I've seen weren't great.
That's the thing, when Alfred...
The Snowman wasn't great,
I know.
Even what I saw.
He said, you know, well, we didn't finish shooting it. And that's right. And the answer is, I don't think that more would make it better.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway, so Tinker Tailor, so I think it's brilliantly directed. I think the use of, you know, music in it incidentally is great. I think the performances are really terrific. But I think the thing that I love most about it is that I do not care about the plot. I care about the plot only in terms of the fact that it is a constant spiraling, increasing thing about anxiety and distrust. And for me, what I find interesting about spy movies is the whole thing. I mean, I love undercover cop movies. It's one of the reasons I love Cruising so much, the William Friedkin film.
That's why I like The Departed so much.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fine.
So that's one of the reasons why that movie stands out to me is Scorsese's best. Okay. I love that. Suspense.
But, and I think that's, you know, cinema is a voyeuristic experience, and watching people watching each other, and so much of Tinker Tailor is about people watching each other.
Yep.
And I could go back into that world and I could inhale that movie because it's that feeling of
unease. You're making me want to watch it again. I haven't watched it for years.
But that's, you know, that's what it is. It is not about spies.
Yeah.
It is about a crisis in maleness I understand completely.
There are three things that stand out to me in that movie, and I haven't seen it for years, so it's just amazing how much it still lives with me. The third one is Colin Firth putting back on his shoes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Brilliant.
Because, and incidentally, that moment is in Secrets of Cinema. It's that thing about the detail that tells you everything.
Yep.
You know, it's so brilliant, isn't it?
It's so brilliant.
It's like the level of deceit involved in putting his shoes back on.
Yep. And the second one is, and as a young filmmaker, I'm always looking for lessons in movies that tell you something that usually would have been done in a clunkier way.
Okay.
So instead of 5 years previous, 5 years later, at the beginning of the movie, they show Gary Oldman's character getting a new pair of glasses. So you know that everything that's happening in present day, he has these glasses on, and everything that's happening in the past, he has those glasses on. That, to me, is what genius filmmaking is. It's little details that just tell you more. So you don't have to go, oh shit, how do people know the difference between the two? It's the same as Greta Gerwig choosing a different palette for Little Women present and the past. Just brilliant decisions like that that again, you say, like, show, don't tell. And the third is the ending sequence that's set to Le Maire, I think it's called. The original French version of Beyond the Sea, which I think is one of the best ending sequences to anything in cinema, it's just so satisfying.
And he comes and he sits down.
Yeah.
And it's...
Da, 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 yeah, da. Yeah. And then, yeah, it's, and that, I mean, I made a web series in 2013. It was the first longer form thing I ever made. And the entire ending sequence to me was inspired by, okay. It's entirely different, but it was inspired by that. That's how much it sort of like crept into my psyche.
And again, we use that end sequence in Secrets of Cinema.
So good. Just taking his place. Like,
so actually, Nick, who is filming and recording this, Nick was the...
Fuck you, Nick.
Fuck you, Nick. Was pretty much the... I mean, Kim Newman was the lead writer on the series, but Nick absolutely led that that Spy Movies episode and, you know, did an awful lot of the writing on it, and both those moments were chosen by Nick. And they are great moments.
Yeah.
We've named the operation Witchcraft.
Well, Percy and his pals bypassed us, Smiley, gone straight to the minister. Percy has been allowed... to keep the identity of his new friend top secret.
The minister agrees with me that too many secrets are blown around here. Too much failure, too many scandals, too little solid intelligence.
Percy does have a point, Control. We should be fighting communism, not each other.
Well, we're losing our reputation, our partners.
You're bloody Yanks!
And we've had enough. There's going to be changes.
We need to decide if we want to be part of the past or part of the future.
I should have left you where I found you.
Look, Control.
All of you!
If witchcraft is genuine.
Nothing is genuine anymore.
Okay, so I took dibs on what I think we all agree.
Yeah.
And so you were left with?
I've gone through, it's a big broad one, but I can explain, I think, why I think it's amazing. Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation.
Ooh.
The fifth one.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah. So cinema is a very personal thing. We all know that. So somebody listening to this is going to go, oh, what, why haven't you picked this one, that one? But when I saw Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, I was ready to see it. Yeah. I was in Los Angeles. I was with my friend, my best friend, Tim.
It's Macquarie.
It's Christopher Macquarie. It's his first one that he did. I was on a beach in Los Angeles, and I found out that there was a screening of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation that day, and I really wanted to see Tim. Okay. And I called my agent, and I was like, is there any way we can sneak me into that film? And then about half an hour later, he called me and said, who's the best agent ever? And we had like reserved Bad Robot seats to see this film. And I remember from the beginning with Joe Kramer's amazing score, that just happening over the logos. I was like, oh, I'm all in for this already. And then the first time that Tom Cruise appears, running through a shot to the dun, 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 like as he jumps onto a plane. I'm just elevated to, this is what I love cinema for. Yeah. It's just these experiences.
He jumps onto the outside of the plane, right?
And then the plane took off.
And then the plane takes off, and it is him.
It is really him.
And he must be tied to it, right?
He's tied to it, yes. But he's wearing these really thick eye lenses so that nothing gets in his eyes.
And in real life. Okay.
Yeah. And he did it 8 times.
Wow.
8 times. And he said he didn't tell his mum that he was doing it until after he'd done it, which is amazing. And
this is literally
hanging on the outside of the plane.
That takes off.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what's impressive as well is that the bit where it lands isn't in the film, but that would have been amazing to see. Like, just filming that as he's like, just insane. So there's all the...
Everyone going, is Tom still alive? Tell him to go again.
Yeah, yeah.
But more intensity.
This is the thing that obviously Mission Impossible has become very known for in its later iterations, is Tom Cruise does batshit insane things for real, on camera for your enjoyment.
See, Tom Cruise break his ankle in real life.
Yeah, yeah, he really did it. And it's in the film. Yeah, so there's that element to it, which is this very, like, almost, because I used to be into wrestling and I really like sort of circus performers and things. I really like that spectacle. So watching Tom Cruise do these amazing things for real is a big part of why I think these movies really work now. And it's just the excitement that no one else does anymore. It's the reason why I love, one of the reasons why I love the film The Mask of Zorro, is that there's a lot of very real stunt work in that. That's like, there's bits where someone like flips around a horse that you just wouldn't see that anymore because everything's led by CGI and all the rest of it. We all know this. I don't have a big problem with it. I'm a big fan of superhero movies, but sometimes it's nice to go, that's fucking real. They really did that, which is why I have a, which is why Rogue Nation wins for me over Fallout, is that I think that Rogue Nation has a more purposeful story, and I'll get to that in a second. Fallout has the amazing stunt where Tom Cruise really jumps out of a plane and they really filmed it, but then they put a load of CGI lightning and stuff around him.
Okay.
So it doesn't really matter. You're watching it going, this doesn't look
I still
real.
Love Fallout though.
It is incredible. It's the ending helicopter stuff alone.
The helicopter's falling down. When
and it really is doing it. Like, you're just watching it. I remember watching it on IMAX and being like, this is just batshit. It feels like I'm watching a documentary about a madman.
And it stars the moustache that isn't in Justice League.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love all the stuff as well with that. Like the reveal that Henry Cavill is a villain when he turns over the phone and it isn't smashed. And everyone goes, I knew it was a villain from there. And Macquarie's like, yeah, because I told you. Show, don't tell. And you think that I made a mistake. Anyway, so Rogue Nation, the main reason why I think it works over Fallout in terms of its as a whole package, the whole thing for me hangs on the opera sequence.
Okay.
The opera sequence to me is like a
which incidentally owes a debt to Dario Argento, but carry on.
Of course it does. The opera sequence to me, I think, is filmmaking wise as good as anything in Parasite. I think that the geography, the way that he's teaching you where everybody is, what everybody's role is, the patience of it is nothing short of genius, and it's just taking its time to get to the crescendo. Like, if you got to the crescendo where there's three different people pointing guns at the same thing and you didn't really understand where everyone was and what was going on, and the opera was getting to a crescendo as well,
yeah.
If you didn't understand all these things, it just would fall on its face. But it's just all these different elements and Macquarie like pulling the strings with the editing, the music design, because the opera doesn't flow like that. They've changed it specifically and worked with Eddie Hamilton, the amazing editor, who I think is the best working editor in Hollywood, to make sure that that sequence hits. And I think it's brilliant. It's so good. I don't know if you remember it specifically, but
I do remember,
the Chancellor is about to get shot.
No, I remember it really.
And there's that moment where you as an audience go, I don't know what he's going to do. And then shooting him in the shoulder is something that you think, like some armchair guy would be like, oh, just shoot him in the shoulder. But actually, in the moment, you're like, I don't know how he's going to get out of this.
Some armchair guy.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just armchair politics and armchair film theory. Yeah. I watched a film with my housemate who's a bit like that. We watched Denis Villeneuve's Prisoners.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of moments in that where there's tension with someone who's got a gun and whatever. And he was like, I would just do this. And I was like, no, Mike, you wouldn't, because you would have a gun pointed at you.
And also there is an underground maze.
Yeah.
I remember that moment of going, what?
Yeah, yeah. So good. But yeah, that moment, that opera sequence, I think you could write several different papers and essays on why that sequence works so well. And then there's everything else that's in it as well that's just as exciting, but I think that moment is my favourite moment in all of Mission Impossible.
Welcome to Vienna, Benji. Miss me?
Ethan, where are you? Where the hell have you been? No, you know what? Please, don't tell me that, because it's just another thing I will have to lie about in my weekly polygraph.
Everything's gonna be fine. Just keep walking. But make sure you're not being followed.
Oh, I didn't win those opera tickets, did I?
No, I'm afraid not.
So where do we meet?
We don't. For your sake, we shouldn't be seen together. You have mail.
Who is he?
That's what we're here to find out. What I do know is he's our only possible link to the syndicate, and I have reason to believe he's going to be here tonight. But I can't find him alone. Are you in? Are you in?
Yes, of course, of course. So what's the play?
Simple. You find him, we tag him, I follow him wherever he goes.
And after that?
After that, you're on a plane. Back at work Monday morning, no one is the wiser.
Wait, that's it?
You're in enough danger as it is. I didn't want to involve you this much, but I had no choice.
Well, if you're going to bring me all this way, you could at least give me something a bit more, you know, dramatic.
Benji, we're trying to keep a low profile. You want drama? Go to the opera.
Look, I think it's a great choice. We're going to have to draw this to a close because we've got to record another one of these. I think those are really good choices, but what we can take away from this is
yep.
I'm going to go away and watch Burn After Reading, and you are going to go away and watch Lost Caution.
And you are going to call it its real title when you've seen
it. When I've seen it again. Jack, I will see you in the very near future. In fact, I think we're going to do kind of regular updates through this whole period. We'll figure out a way of recording remotely because you and I don't live in the same towns.
No.
And we'll do kind of a bunch of bonus episodes, because I think at the moment, particularly, you know, it's nice to have extra stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know? And I think that everybody who's sending us suggestions for things that we can do on Twitter is really helpful, actually.
Yes, please.
It gives us a good gauge of what you're enjoying listening to us talk about.
It really does. Thank you for listening, and please keep it up. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please keep it up. That doesn't sound right.
Come on.
Thank you for listening. if you've enjoyed the podcast, remember to subscribe, tell your friends, all the usual stuff. But please, please, please stay safe. Well, there we are. That was Jack Howard and I discussing our favourite spy movies. As I said before, Secrets of Cinema Spies is on BBC4 at 9 o'clock this week. And if you're listening after that's happened, or you can't watch at 9 o'clock, then you can go to BBC iPlayer anytime after 9 o'clock on Thursday. And you can watch not only that programme, but all of the second series. And indeed, the whole of the first series is returning to BBC4 in the next few weeks, so that'll be on iPlayer too. And if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, then why not help support the Kermit on Film podcast by visiting our Patreon page? There's loads of exclusive content there, video that you can't get elsewhere, and a whole bunch of other things to keep you coming back for more. We really do appreciate your support. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, everyone.